Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting across from Jock Sorong. Talk about his book, On the Java Ridge. Welcome, Jock.
Thanks, John.
Now, this book's going to start some discussions, I believe. It's almost coming true, which terrifies me a little bit, with Peter Dutton's home. What is he now?
The Super Ministry.
It's only a few steps away, I think, from what you're predicting, or what is it? What would you consider? Is it prophesizing or imagining?
All I did was slightly exaggerate the current state of play, and it was only a small exaggeration. But you're right, when I saw that photo the other day of the SAS soldiers and Malcolm Turnbull and the rubber ducky up the back, I just thought, God, you can't script this stuff. You know, it almost makes writers redundant.
Yeah, it was like the poor people who are running in America with Donald Trump in charge.
Yeah, or Utopia here.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, this can't be happening. It's how do you keep ahead of this sort of thing? How do writers of novels keep ahead? Because it takes a while to write a novel. You get an idea. It takes period sort of the idea to get formulated in your head. It takes a long time to write the damn thing.
Yep.
And in that time, Donald Trump could be in president.
That's right. I suppose there's a whole lot of frantic editing at the back end when you suddenly look at what's happened during the 18 months that you wrote and you think, God, they've overtaken us again.
Before we go any further, let's set the scene. Just give me the setup of the book.
Well, the idea is that if you look at the geography of where Australian surfers go on these boat charters in Indonesia, the routes that those boats take, they very often intersect with the routes that asylum seeker boats have been using to get to Australia. And in particular, over at the eastern end of Indonesia, over near Sumba, there are asylum seeker boats that come down from the north, from Makassar and places like that, heading for Ashmore Reef. And there are surf charter boats in that vicinity at times. And the idea had occurred to me that it's not improbable that at some stage the two boats could meet. An Australian surf charter full of affluent Australians who saved up their money to go on a holiday, and a boat full of asylum seekers. And from there, I suppose the hook that I devised was that these two boats have come into contact in a storm, in a state of some distress, and 8 days out from a federal election. So that back in Canberra, you've got politicians desperately trying to make the thing disappear, while these people are engaged in a sort of life and death struggle in the islands.
And so the way I was sort of sold the book is that it's got this thriller aspect to it, but there's a sense of your previous books where you take on these issues that seem to be right bubbling on the surface of what's going on right now, and you insert either a crime element or some sort of a thriller element to it. How do you describe your books? I mean, you help a bookseller out, man.
Well, it's a difficult question because I suppose, you know, I'm writing my fourth book at the moment and I feel like I'm still trying to work out what my identity as a novelist is. But to me, I want to write about issues, as you say. I want to write about the things that get under our skin as Australians. And I don't want to write polemics. I don't want to go standing on a soapbox saying this is how it is morally or this is how it is politically. So I try to work through plot and character to explore how these things feel to normal people. The people on the boat are not necessarily political zealots. They've all got their various views about asylum seekers, but they're thrown into a situation where they have to examine what they do believe. And I think that's the easiest, not the easiest, but that's the most effective way to look at these sorts of issues, is to bounce them off ordinary characters. So that's why the use of plot and character, they're not just window dressing on a social commentary. They're very important devices in moving the argument through.
When you said that, my first thought was of Frankenstein. I don't know if you've...
Yes.
Yeah, but he's created and he has to examine us from a point of not knowing us. And that gives the author the opportunity to describe us in a way and show us in a sort of objective viewpoint. I think later on Heinlein did it with Stranger from a Strange Land. Yes. That opportunity to examine these opinions and these behaviours from a position that isn't shared. Bringing these people into that circumstance, you place them out of their comfort zone into a circumstance and show them and crash them together.
People in extremis.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that started, I guess, with Quota, that as a lawyer, I didn't have a very good eye for thinking through the technical stuff because I was always so captivated by the stories. And when you work with people, particularly as a criminal defence lawyer, you're seeing people in the worst day or the worst week or the worst month of their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's a very fraught environment, and it's also extremely confidential. And I was always fascinated by the ways that people appear in that, under that sort of stress. So yeah, I guess that, you're right, is carrying through the subsequent novels. It's the most interesting way to look at people.
And it's also, if you did do a polemic, we wouldn't be talking.
Exactly.
So but you actually tell a story that's engaging, you've got the person sitting down, holding the book, and hopefully by the end of the book having experienced other viewpoints than their own.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
That's pretty much the aim, isn't it?
It is. And it's also, I suppose, starting out with quota and then moving through backyard cricket, I was very quickly cast as a crime writer, and I'm fine with that. I don't mind what anyone calls me as long as they call me something. But it got me thinking about, I wonder where the boundaries of that genre are. Yeah. And there's some sort of conscience-driven stuff that you can do at the outer limits and still probably call it crime. Mm-hmm. And Java Ridge won't be called a crime novel, despite the fact there's crimes going on left, right and centre. And I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, if I'm doing my cleaning up in my shop and I'm walking down with your book and I'm going to put in Australian thrillers, that's my idea, because I want people to understand what kind of book it is, in the sense of what they're going to get. But you've also packed it with other things, like little surprises in there that they probably wouldn't be expecting. I mean, the other place that I would just bonk it because it's so beautifully written is Australian literature.
I'll happily sit there.
It's good. I mean, the way you write is divine. I mean, it really is a lovely style that you have, and it is. It's nice to see that kind of writing, that high level of writing with this very engaging story, because it's one of those things that a lot of, when I get into arguments about commercial versus literature, and the things that people say on the commercial side is, it's so boring, nothing ever happens. Why are they always talking, and nothing actually happens? But if you can bring all everything together, and I think they're some of the greatest writers of all time, you know, Dickens and the Brontes, and these people have stuff going on in their books. But plus they've got the detail, plus they've got the motivations, the characters, and the fine writing, all in the one package. I don't see why we can't do that.
I've just come through this little journey. I read Sebastian Barry's Days Without End, and then back to back with that, I'm reading Blood Meridian. Mm-hmm. And
you're okay?
Yeah, I feel like I just need to go and recover somewhere quiet. Yes. It's an incredibly intense journey, but it does what you're talking about, and that is that both authors pack in a tremendous amount of violence and a tremendous amount of action generally. There's a lot of geography in them, and yet in these small, tight sentences, it's really sparse writing. Mm. And the effect is so strong if you can get that right. And sometimes I think it's the tension between the writer wanting to be lyrical and a really wise editor who can say, righto, you've done that on this page, cut it back.
Yeah.
If you can get that tension right, then yes, you can compress a lot of action into some really tight lyrical writing.
That leads into another question, is what are the things that you are reading to become the writer that you are? I mean, I definitely feel the effects of writers when I'm especially in awe of them for a moment. I'll find my pen writing in their style for a bit.
Yes.
I have to shake it out. Who are you reading? Who are the people that really influenced you as a writer?
Well, I think for a long time before I started writing novels, I was really reading old stuff. I was reading the Russians like Dostoevsky and Pushkin and Gogol, and I was reading older American writers like Conrad, and my idea of modern was probably Saul Bellow. Since I've started writing novels, I've made a really conscious effort to read much more diversely, and with sometimes positive results, and sometimes I think that can get in the way, but the important thing is to read flat out. Like, I remember when I was writing Quota, I had a bit of a craze on David Foster Wallace, and all that did was make me horribly verbose, and it all had to be hacked back out again. But then you read other people who write in a very, very tight way, and I'm trying to think of good examples, but Favel Parrott or Emma Visick or someone like that, or there's a young adult author called Mark Smith. People who are able to maintain a sort of, it's almost an Australian Gothic ethic, but it's that's pulled me right away from those earlier influences that were a lot more wordy.
It does affect you. I mean, I started to fall in love with you a little bit when you started talking about Dostoevsky and that sort of stuff, so I'm just going to try to pull back a little bit. But those are my early influences as well, and you do end up having to kind of shake it off because it just doesn't really work for a lot of the stuff that you want to write today, and the audience expects today as well. There's that problem.
I think what you're doing when you read those really great writers, hopefully, is you're sort of straining it through a cloth. Mm. You're trying to derive some kind of essence from what you're reading without openly mimicking it.
Yeah.
And when you catch yourself mimicking it, it's time to take a long, hard look at yourself and change your influences, I think.
Do you feel... some of the times I read a writer who's writing so beautifully and it's over. Like it's only 300 pages or something, and you think, oh, give me something bigger and substantial. I keep talking to, I think she's probably sick of me saying it, but Charlotte Wood, and saying, give me an epic.
Yeah.
I can put up with your writing for days. Just give me these little snippet things. Do you get that? There is definitely a place for those kind of larger books, but it's being filled by people like Ken Follett and these kind of writers rather than more literary writers. A lot of literary writers haven't got either, I don't know, the time or the, I don't know why it's not seeming to be those kind of larger stories not being told by more literary writers.
Well, it's a really interesting question. I wonder if there's some pushback from publishers that the marketing task is made more difficult, and that one way of looking at that is that you need to have had the years and the novels and the following behind you that people are going to take it on faith that it's worth the journey.
Yeah.
Where if you pop out of nowhere with an absolute doorstopper, they might not take the chance on you. Another way of looking at that, the material I'm working with at the moment is either one gigantic tome or it's a trilogy, and maybe that's the wiser move. It also gives you some breathing room along the way, you know, rather than going and disappearing for 5 years.
Yeah, well, that is the problem in this world. That sense. Look, there's quite a lot of authors that come through here, and they are thinking about the 2-book-a-year thing because of just how quick it is happening. And if you're on social media, it seems to even be faster. You publish a book, a day later, someone tweets going, "That was great." You're like, why did I spend a year and a half on that?
Yeah.
And you're done. You want another one?
Well, that's the thing that happens. You often get text messages from your mates saying, you know, I flew to Bali and I smashed your novel on the plane.
Yeah.
Oh, God, you have no idea what went into that.
Yeah. Don't do that to me. But it is difficult, and there is that sense that from the audience, and because the machine is behind things. I mean, you're safe. You've got text publishing looking after you. They're very considerate publishers.
It's a warm embrace.
Yes, it is a beautiful thing. But there is that pressure on a lot of authors. We get it here when someone does something like a Vogel Prize winner, and we talk to them and go, "So when's the next book?" And they're going, "Next book?"
Just come up for air.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
I think what you're leading to is a much graver question about how we absorb stories. That I think a lot of people, and I'm not criticising anybody because I do it, will lie in bed with a book and every 15 minutes they'll have a look at their phone. Now, I wonder what's going on the phone. Now, if we're doing that, and if that's the way we're reading novels, then how are we going to persist through something that's 800 pages?
Yeah.
You know, is the era of that sort of writing starting to recede?
Yeah, I'm very hopeful that it's going the other way because bookselling around the world and publishing around the world is seeing a little bit of a resurgence within the printed book. And I think one of the things leading to it is, even though you've got that book, that phone next to you, and you may be checking it every once in a while, you're not on the phone. You're reading a book.
Yes.
You're checking on the phone, which is a different thing. But if you're on your phone pretending to read an e-book, and there's notifications coming through at all times, and you can't really do it. But I think people are using books to chill out to in a more and more, which is a good, for me as a bookseller, a good sign, but I think also for a culture, a good sign, because we need to concentrate on one thing and actually get that thing done.
Yep. Well, we might have reached critical mass with the binging and the notifications, and we're looking to retreat into the analogue somehow.
Yeah.
And there's nothing better than a physical book to do it.
Well, I do get a little excited when... when I see the size of a Hilary Mantel or a,
even
you know, people who want to read all the Game of Thrones, I think to myself, that's great training.
Yes, you know, yes.
You're sitting down for that long. That's really good to see. Like those at the end of the Harry Potter, you know, teaching kids. She's almost taught kids how to sit down for whoppers, you know, for long periods of time and put investment into something. And that generation seems to be a generation that has that skill now, because they were forced to do it with the Harry Potter hysteria.
Well, we discovered, my wife and I discovered the other day that our 10-year-old son was up at 2 a.m. because he was finishing a novel. And we went through this debate about, do we get cross with him? That's fantastic.
You're doing
high fives. Tuesday. But
yeah, high-fiving.
He'll be a zombie tomorrow, but good on him.
I want to talk about the politics side of things, because this book has an edge to it, and it has that sense of privatising everything, and that drift towards it, and what is government for, and who can we trust, and what's expedient. Those kinds of things are raised in here. Are you an optimistic kind of guy about the future, or you've got a little bit of pessimism?
I think I'm a pessimist, to be honest with you, but in writing the book, I was exploring the way I feel about the politics around this issue and our political discourse generally, because I think there's a lot of things that I don't know the answers to, and I'm not going to preach from on high about these things. I very firmly believe that there is a moral vacuum around asylum seekers in this country, and that it's reflective of something wider about Australians along the lines of, provided that a problem is out of sight, we're okay with it. Mm. And maybe the underlying question in this novel is it possible that there's no such thing as a free kick, that you can put brown people on an island and forget that they're there and believe that you have secure borders, why ever it is that that is an advantage, and also believe that no one is being damaged, or if anyone's being damaged, it's the brown people in the camp and we don't have to look. Mm. And what Java Ridge explores is maybe there is damage leaking out in our psyche and in our society that we're not thinking about. And it's not necessarily the people in the camps, although it clearly is them.
Yeah.
And that's why I wanted the minister to get tangled up in it and to trip over his own conscience along the way, and that's why the Australian Surfers are there as agents of that idea, that these are people for whom the asylum seeker debate should be neatly put in a corner where they don't have to look, but all of a sudden it's right up under their noses. And as you alluded to, the business of outsourcing human rights obligations to corporations is a part of that looking away.
Mm.
And this was an opportunity, I suppose, to study that and to say, well, if you do park some very, very difficult moral and practical issues under the confidential aegis of a corporation, then it's a giant gesture of trust. And given that they're driven by profit, of course they're going to abuse the trust eventually, if not today or tomorrow, at some point. And I think, you know, there is, of course, there is not a corporation called Core Resolve that patrols the seas, but there are plenty of listed corporations that run detention centres, that run juvenile justice centres.
Security.
Who provide services to Indigenous Australians. And we take an awful lot on trust along the way in exchange for the sort of complacency of not having to think about it.
Yeah, and that one step remove, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
You literally then, almost like a radioactive effect, that you've got this one moral thing that we're trying to push away, but having made that choice that it might leak out amongst.
Yes.
Are you referring to a sort of a corruption of our own morality, or are you talking about the opportunities for things like homegrown terrorism some kind of rise of Pauline Hanson, that sort of thing? What were you kind of, is it like having made that decision, having looked away, what is it that we're exposed to?
We're exposed to consequence. We think we're insulated from consequence, but we're not. And if the other side of the model is that you have the government run these things, then what you are then capable of doing is looking inside, at least to a degree. When a corporation runs it, you're not. And consequence is going to find its way out at some stage. And Java Ridge is me thinking about the notion that, as I say, the moral consequences of turning away asylum seekers in a very dangerous way, which we're already doing, are eventually going to come home to us. It's not a case that we've simply quarantined the problem.
Right, yeah. Jock, we have reached the end of our time for our podcast, which is sad because I could talk to you all afternoon.
And I feel like I was just winding up.
Yeah, I was just trying to... There's so many things we can talk about because this novel really does... And it's one of those great novels for a book club or a discussion group of some kind, because it will touch on... Everyone has their own opinions about this sort of stuff. And the great thing about novels is they can get in there between the cracks and maybe break it open just a little bit. Without really knowing it. Sometimes it hits you later on. Sometimes
yes.
it hits you down the road. You're driving, you go, hey, wait a second.
Here it comes.
Jock just said. So I do recommend it for book clubs and on that side, because it will get people chatting. I think even outside of that, I think you've already started with some of the reviews you're getting. So congratulations on the book.
Thanks, Jock.
And you can get Jock's book from booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.